I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land we are on, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you all here for this lecture. The Centre for Advanced Journalism, which is hosting the lecture, has its mission to improve the practice of journalism in Australia. We have a public outreach program which is designed to provide lectures, seminars, discussions that connect the public with the media. Tonight's lecture is part of that process. It is in the context of the Centre's goal of doing what we can to improve journalism in Australia and our region that I am thrilled, truly thrilled, that Paul Keating agreed to give this lecture tonight. On any reckoning, Paul Keating is a giant of Australian politics. I think in the current context we're in, he becomes a bigger giant every day. Perhaps, if I may dare to say, perhaps he's the Placido Domingo of Australian politics. I'm sure that the lecture we are about to hear will be a reminder, if we need one, of how important it is to have a real discussion about the way the media operates and about the way it affects the lives of all of us. Can I now invite the Vice-Chancellor, Glyn Davis, to formally welcome and introduce Mr. Keating.
Michael, thank you, and thank you to all our distinguished guests, those here and those in the overflow rooms, because demand to hear this lecture was profound. Thank you all for joining us at what will be a fascinating event. May I join Michael in acknowledging the Indigenous owners of this land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. Once upon a time, we had a Prime Minister who, in a famous speech, reminded us that we non-Indigenous Australians are the beneficiaries of people who reached out and allowed us on their land, even those of us who arrived in small boats. That Prime Minister said that we have built a prosperous and remarkably harmonious society in this country, and I quote, "So surely we can find just solutions to the problems which beset the first Australians," as he said, "the people to whom the most injustice has been done." Those fine words from the 1992 Redfern speech were spoken by the person we've gathered to hear tonight. A wonderful opportunity to advance the research and the public debate about media and journalism, an agenda which has taken great steps here at Melbourne since the opening of the Centre for Advanced Journalism 2 years ago under the distinguished leadership of Michael Gawenda. Our guest lecturer this evening is, of course, is Mr. Paul Keating, the 24th Prime Minister of Australia, serving between 1993 and 1996, and 1991, that should be, in 1996, and the Treasurer of the Commonwealth Government from 1983 till 1991. Amongst his many distinctions, Mr. Keating is a public figure well known for an extraordinary command of words. He once described being attacked by a particular opposition leader as being flogged with a warm lettuce. I suspect some of that rich imagery may flow tonight. Tonight he's agreed to demonstrate his formidable persuasive skills by persuading us on the important topic of the privacy imperative of the information age free-for-all. Please welcome tonight's guest lecturer, Mr. Paul Keating.
Well, thank you, Vice-Chancellor Michael Gawenda, the Director of the Centre of Advanced Journalism, the Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen. Well, of course, this is an election campaign, but this is not an election campaign speech. But it is a campaign speech. It's a speech about another subject, and one I think is important, and for which I was pleased to accept Michael's invitation to speak to the Centre for Advanced Journalism, because even though I've had much to do with journalists over the years, and I'll let you in on a secret, I do really like journalists, even though a lot of them don't think I do. I was therefore delighted to accept the invitation and to think about what subject I might address. And the one running through my mind, and had been, is the one I've chosen for tonight. So I go on a bit here tonight. If you haven't had a comfort stop, you'll need one at the end. but nevertheless, you'll have to bear with me. I start out with a quotation, and you'll pick up the resonances of it. It says, "The press is overstepping in every direction the obvious bounds of propriety and of decency. Gossip is no longer the resource of the idle and of the vicious, but has become a trade, which is pursued with industry as well as effrontery. To satisfy a purient taste, the details of sexual relations are spread broadcast in the columns of the daily papers. To occupy the indolent, column upon column is filled with idle gossip, which can only be procured by intrusion upon the domestic circle. In this, as in other branches of commerce, the supply creates the demand. Each crop of unseemly gossip thus harvested becomes a seed of more, and in direct proportion to its circulation, results in the lowering of social standards and of morality. Even gossip, apparently harmless when widely and persistently circulated, is potent for evil. It both belittles and perverts. It belittles by inverting the relative importance of things, thus dwarfing the thoughts and aspirations of a people. When personal gossip obtains the dignity of print and crowds the space available for matters of real interest to the community, what wonder that the ignorant and thoughtless mistake its relative importance." Now, of course, a few elements of the language are a giveaway that the piece wasn't written by me or written yesterday. But the content is highly relevant to a discussion about privacy and the media, as a trip to the local newsagent or time spent in front of the television or online will quickly affirm. The quote is from The Right to Privacy by the Boston lawyers Samuel Warren and Lewis Brandeis, published in the Harvard Law Review in 1890. Perhaps the most famous attempt at a definition of privacy. Warren and Brandeis wrote that the right of the individual to be let alone, I repeat that, the right of the individual to be let alone, a right they put alongside the right not to be assaulted or beaten, the right not to be imprisoned, the right not to be maliciously prosecuted, the right not to be defamed, is a key right. They have, of course, acknowledged that the right to be let alone was not absolute and must on occasion give way to a higher or general public interest. Of course, none of us can assert that we should be left alone perpetually. However, they said, and let me quote them further, "The design of the law must be to protect those persons with whose affairs the community has no legitimate concern from being dragged into an undesirable and undesired publicity, and to protect all persons whatsoever, their position or station, from having matters which they may properly prefer to keep private made public against their will. It is the unwarranted invasion of individual privacy which is reprehended and to be as far as possible prevented." Warren was said to have been prompted to write this after a newspaper published the guest list of an A-list dinner party he had hosted in Boston. And Brandeis went on to become a Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Well, of course, both writers would turn in their respective graves at developments in the 120 years since. Whole industries now revolve around so-called celebrity, fame, rumour and gossip, often more correctly, straight fiction, which is published these days often by media organisations. These organisations proclaim the importance of free speech in the dissemination of news, but clearly are more at home in the entertainment business. The Warren and Brandeis concept of privacy strongly influenced the development of the law in the United States and elsewhere, although, as others have pointed out, the right to be let alone as a bald statement is meaningless. Of course, a person engaged in criminal activity has no right to be let alone. And, of course, it is difficult to distinguish from other legal concepts, such as assault or nuisance and interference with bodily integrity. But privacy has been enshrined as an internationally recognised human right in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and Australia is a party to both. Article 17 of the Covenant states, "No one shall be subjected to arbitrary or unlawful interference with his privacy, family, home or correspondence, nor to unlawful attacks on his honour and reputation." And two, "Everyone has the rights to the protection of the law against such interference or attacks." Freedom of expression is also an internationally recognised human right in Article 19 of the Covenant. It says, these rights are not absolute, sometimes conflicted, and often need to be balanced and reconciled. Importantly, and this I think is a really important point, free speech means freedom governed by law. Privacy, in a broad sense, is under attack these days on a range of fronts. Electronic surveillance, terrorism laws, growing police powers, these peek and seek provisions, police coming to your home, cleaning your computer, putting bugs in your telephone, business practices associated with information mining and marketing, and new technologies. And the battle Warren and Brandeis fought against the evil of gossip has been well and truly lost in the passage of time. However, the right to what I might call privacy remains an issue, particularly where to draw the line between freedom of expression and any remaining right an individual has to have some control over the gathering and publication of information about personal aspects of their life, and what can or should be done when that line is crossed. I take issue with and repudiate those who assert that privacy in modern times is dead and we should get over it. People say this, look, don't go on about it, it's all over. And with those who claim the current framework within which the media deals with privacy issues and concerns is effective and works well. It is, of course, ineffective and works, in the main, to the benefit of media organisations. I also want to lend support to the case made strongly and convincingly in two Law Reform Commission reports that you won't see widely reported or subject to objective analysis in the media, that the law should provide recourse in the event of an unwarranted serious breach of an individual's privacy by the media or anyone else for that matter. These issues are topical owing to obvious examples of questionable calls about balancing privacy and freedom of expression, and they're there for all to see. Some leaders of the industry and the profession dismiss errors as unfortunate, inevitable and rare, and claim a strong and continuing commitment to ethics and values that include respect for privacy. I know many good editors and journalists struggle with these issues. In fact, every editor must struggle with them every day, conscious of their responsibilities to get it right and the harmful effect of getting it wrong. But many, like me, have the impression that the tone at the top and the practice of journalism in many media organisations is driven by other more pressing values. Of course, it's hard to generalise, but Margaret Simons, who authored the book The Content Makers, suggests, and research by Dennis Muller for his PhD at this university in 2005, and with 27 years' experience in the profession, confirmed, ethics do not enjoy a high profile in the newsroom. Indeed, many of those involved apparently have little more than a passing knowledge of the issues. Ethical considerations can complicate life for those keen to get the story. Muller described it as a pretty sorry picture. Or as Professor Mark Pearson put it, and I'll quote him, The reality is that editors and news directors are motivated as much by circulation and ratings as by a public duty to deliver the news. There may be a range of profits or costs resulting from a story involving a privacy intrusion, including gained or lost circulation or ratings, advertising, syndication rights, corporate reputations, legal damages, and court or regulator costs. There's little doubt journalists go through such a process, either informally or formally or informally, when deciding to run a story that pushes at the privacy margins. Often questionable calls involve people in the news for other reasons. Photographs claimed to be of a red-headed woman engaged in politics, scantily clad in a motel room with someone else 30 years ago. Of an apparently happily married government minister leaving a gay men's haunt, or of a so-called celebrity in the shower. The rights and wrongs of these calls tend to become topics of discussion themselves. Probably much more frequently, although no one seems to keep tabs, individuals going about their daily life or momentarily caught in the spotlight then become the subject of a questionable call. Those leaving court, particularly where they react angrily to being filmed, as always seems to have news value, as did a full frontal front page photo of a family that heard the news of the death of a family member for the first time in Victoria's bushfires last year. Then there was the photo in Sydney papers last year of two small children, faces not visible, but children of a murderer just convicted, one child wearing a school uniform on the way to school. And in another, a badly injured and distressed son whose parents had been killed in a boating accident, angrily seeking to avoid a camera recording his stretcher-borne arrival at hospital. Just about any day in the tabloids and any night on A Current Affair or Today Tonight, you will see examples, including foot-in-the-door interviews claimed to be necessary and justified by the media's right to know and to publish just about anything they like. The issue of media and privacy is also topical owing to proposals in a 2008 report by the Australian Law Reform Commission on Australia's privacy laws. The report, the result of 2 years' research, consultation and analysis, runs to 2,700 pages in three volumes. It put forward 295 recommendations for change, with the general aim of modernising, simplifying and streamlining laws that are generally seen to be dated, complex, confusing, fragmented and full of gaps and inconsistencies. Four recommendations are of direct relevance to the media. None have yet received a response from the government. They propose changes to, but continuation of, the largely self-regulatory arrangements that are a condition of the exemption which media organisations enjoy from privacy law. The Australian Law Reform Commission argued changes were necessary because of ongoing concerns about the capacity of the self-regulatory system to preserve that tenuous balance between the public interest in freedom of expression and the public interest in adequately safeguarding the handling of personal information. This important report also recommended legislation to establish a general statutory cause of action for breach of privacy. A general statutory cause of action for breach of privacy, but subject to a number of qualifiers to ensure the protection of other public interests. One of the reasons given was to create more certainty for everybody, including the media, as to legal rights, rather than leave the law entirely to case law with judges developing the common law over time. The Commission supported an argument by yet another report, a separate report, by the New South Wales Law Reform Commission in 2008, made clear the proposal for a statutory cause of action is not aimed specifically or solely at the media. The proposal is for a right to seek redress for a serious interference to privacy, including interference with an individual's home or family life, unauthorised surveillance, or where an individual's correspondence or private written, oral or electronic communication has been interfered with, misused or disclosed. Of special interest to the media, of course, is that it would also extend to an interference with privacy involving disclosure of sensitive facts relating to an individual's private life, subject to a rider concerning the public interest in people being informed about matters of public concern and the public interest, of course, in freedom of expression, which must accompany it. Well, reaction to the Law Reform Commission's report, not limited to the proposed cause of action, took on an end of the world as we know it tone in some media circles. The report and recommendations were dismissed by industry leaders such as John Hardigan of News Limited and the Australia's Right to Know Coalition on the basis that the current media privacy framework is effective and working well. Hardigan asserted, and I quote him, "There are very few complaints, investigations and breach findings against the media for breaches of privacy." The Australian's legal affairs editor, Chris Merritt, labelled the report outrageous. On the cause of action, an editorial in The Australian set up a marvellous straw man. Privacy, it said, is important, but it would be a serious mistake to remake the rules governing the operation of the media by enshrining privacy as an inalienable right, which at all times and in all circumstances trumps all other considerations. But they said this despite the fact that the Australian Law Reform Commission specifically stated the cause of action should only be available for a serious breach, and, I quote them, privacy interests are not to be privileged over other rights and interests. In other words, if there is a public interest, a clear public interest, there is no precedence in privacy over it. Well, there were confident predictions from some that the proposal, if acted upon, would put an immediate end to investigative journalism, notwithstanding that the Commission concluded the proposal, and I quote it, should not hinder legitimate investigative journalism as described by media groups to this inquiry. For example, allegations of misconduct or corruption in public life would not fall within the proposed zone of protection. Some media voices call for calm consideration, suggesting a need to get the house in order before jumping to the barricades. Jack Waterford, the editor-at-large at the Canberra Times, while mindful of the need to protect freedom of the press and freedom of speech, as you would expect, commented about the wave of criticisms of the Commission's report, particularly in News Corporation, News Limited publications. With an eye for self-interest, when he saw it running, Waterford said, and I'll quote him, "The public ought to be quite cynical of the fact that some sections of the commercial media thrive and profit from invading the privacy of celebrities, starlets, models, and sometimes ordinary non-consenting members of the public who've stumbled into a public spotlight. Trivial gossip has become bigger and bigger business in most cases with the implicit consent of most of the victims, but has very little to do with the public interest or with reasons why the media can or ought to be able to claim that in respect of its monitoring of the exercise of public power, it is acting in the public interest." That's from Jack Waterford of the Canberra Times. Matthew Ricketson of The Age thought some of the claims for free speech for the media celebrity industry was simply laughable. He said this, "In the weeks leading up to the release of the Australian Law Reform Commission's massive report on privacy, the Right to Know Coalition has been sounding the alarm at the prospect of a new law against invasion of privacy. Privacy threat to celebrity coverage was a headline in the media supplement of the Australian on July 31, 2008. I'll repeat it, privacy threat to celebrity coverage. And it began this, its lead story, "The celebrity media industry could be thrown into turmoil by moves to restrict reporting on public figures." Am I the only person, Ricketson asked, who thinks this reads rather like an item in the satirical American newspaper The Onion or an outtake from The Chaser? Well, Matthew Ricketson, no, you're not. But another prominent industry leader, Mark Scott of the ABC, also broke ranks in suggesting that the media should seek to negotiate a suitable outcome on the proposed statutory cause of action rather than leave the development of the law in the hands of the courts. But let me for a minute return to those questionable calls. News Limited's The Daily Telegraph conceded that the redhead alleged to be in those photos published last year in the lead-up to the Queensland election, Pauline Hanson, in fact wasn't her, and according to reports, settle a legal action she commenced soon thereafter. The deputy editor's first go at defending the publication of what at the time the Telegraph insisted were photos of Hanson was, quote, the public interest. When questioned about the precise public interest involved, she said, that's for our readers to tell. That will be determined by the number of people that buy the paper. Now, this is how brazen it's become. A bit similar to the line of the then editor of the same paper, who at the time defended the publication online of a photo taken by a phone camera of Sonny Bill Williams and the actress Candace Falzon in flagrante in a toilet cubicle with a door closed at a Sydney hotel. He told Monica Attard, that's the editor of the Telegraph, it is currently the second highest read story of the year so far. The readers clearly loved it. So there you have it then. The readers loved it. You take it. Hanson would not have succeeded under the proposed cause of action because she claimed, and news publications eventually conceded, it was not her in the photos, so there was no serious breach of her privacy. Whoever it was in them has not stepped forward, perhaps with an eye to maintaining privacy about something that happened 30 years ago. But this is worth noting. The public apology by the Telegraph editor to Hanson was that the photos were of someone else. In other words, in the apology says, well, don't worry, the photos were of someone else, suggesting that had they been of Hanson, the public interest lay in their publication, despite the passage of time and the irrelevance of the event to her campaign for office. Peter Meakin of the Seven Network initially defended the outing of the New South Wales Transport Minister David Campbell through footage taken from the street of Campbell's leaving Kens of Kensington in Sydney, as in the public interest, that being in his use of the government-provided car Campbell used to drive there. This was quickly dropped when it turned out there had been no breach of any rules or guidelines for the use of Campbell's vehicle. So other claims about the public interest in knowing the details of the private life of Minister of the Crown were quickly rolled out. The incident, of course, raises the issue of whether anything done in public, that is, whether you're leaving a gay haunt through the front door, visible from the street, for example, can be regarded as private. Mark Day, for example, argues that everything done in public is open slather to the media. Expectations of complete privacy in a public space for any of us, of course, have to be lower than, say, even a decade ago, and those of someone in public life even lower. But all of us should have a right to go about entirely personal business in the public domain. On privacy in the shower, the picture taken of Lara Bingle from a distance through a window, the AFL cleared Brendan Favola in March over his part in the publication of that picture in the Woman's Day and elsewhere on the grounds there was insufficient evidence to show he had distributed the photograph taken while the pair were having an affair in 2006. It was reported in March that Bingle was suing Favola for breach of privacy, defamation and misuse of her image, prompting News Limited lawyer Justin Quill to almost chortle while offering his free legal advice in an op-ed published in the Herald Sun. Quill said this, there is no right to privacy in Australia. I can write that a few different ways if you like, but it won't change the position. You hear a lot of people talking about their right to privacy, but unless they're talking about some moral right to privacy, they're talking about something that doesn't exist in this country. Taking a photo of a woman in the shower and distributing it is unquestionably reprehensible on any view, he said. But we shouldn't feel so sorry for Bingle that we demand a privacy law. Quill acknowledged she might possibly have a claim for breach of confidence, but on privacy rights, she had nothing. And that, of course, right from the relevant authority in the land, the News Limited lawyer. Managing privacy must be part of a broader framework concerning ethics and values in journalism, an essential framework given the media's exercise of significant public power, privilege, and the potential to cause harm. I mean, I think this is true. The media's exercise of significant public power, privilege, and the potential to cause harm. This framework is, in fact, key to the conditional exemption media organisations enjoy from the Privacy Act. The Privacy Act was introduced by the Hawke government in 1988. It initially applied only to the federal public sector, and to credit reporting. In 2000, the Howard government extended the Act to cover big business. Media organisations were granted a conditional exemption for acts and practices in the course of journalism from the provisions of the Act. The fact that an exemption was given reflected the importance attached to the public interest in freedom of expression and the free flow of information in our democratic society. The imposition of conditions was an attempt to balance the public interest in freedom of expression and the public interest in adequately safeguarding the handling of personal information. Significantly, all that is required to enjoy the exemption is for a public commitment by a media organisation, a company, to observe standards of privacy in the course of its journalism, and that those standards be published in writing. That's it. That's all they have to do to earn and enjoy the exemption. Most print and all broadcast media seek to satisfy these conditions through codes or principles that apply to the conduct of their functions under the auspices of an industry group. In the case of broadcast media, there are a number of industry bodies that operate in a co-regulated system under the Broadcast Services Act, administered by ACMAR, the Australian Communications and Media Authority. Seven separate codes apply to commercial television and other forms of broadcasting. Non-compliance with a registered code may give rise to issues concerning such things as the continuation of the licence or the imposition of licence conditions. The ABC and SBS, in fact, have their own codes. The print media is self-regulating, with most of the industry members of the Australian Press Council subject to its statement of principles and standards. Members, journalists mostly, members of the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance, but not other journalists, are bound by its code of ethics. Estimates of MEAA coverage vary from the Alliance's claim of 80% to something around 50% by others. Some large media organisations have their own code and train to a standard that may differ from the MEAA code. Commercial television stations, through Free TV Australia, undertake to comply with the 2010 Code of Practice, registered as a code under the Broadcasting Services Act. In other words, it's all over the place. There's all these different systems. Commentators point to gaps. Few address specific issues concerning such things as the privacy of children, but they point to gaps, lack of transparency and independence in the investigation of complaints, overlap and differences between codes, and weak enforcement mechanisms, though ACMAR can seek enforceable undertakings. The Australian Press Council complaints process, for example, has no power to penalise or make an order against a publication. No power whatsoever. No one has ever been expelled from the MEAA for a breach of standards. Media organisations defend the arrangements, arguing that change is unwarranted and unnecessary. Australia's Right to Know, for example, stated, media privacy issues are best managed by industry-specific codes of practice. The existing media privacy framework provides all the appropriate mechanisms for dealing with privacy in the media. The current media privacy framework is effective and working well, it says. This is evidenced by low numbers of complaints, investigations, and breach findings. In addition to existing codes of practice that deal specifically with privacy, media in Australia are subject to a wide range of federal and state laws which protect private rights and interests, it says. It goes on to say, any proposal to enhance the rigours of existing media privacy regulation must be limited to addressing specific identified public interest concerns regarding the media's treatment of privacy issues. Well, the fact is, the system of self-regulation set up under the general exemption from the Privacy Act is more or less a set of hometown arrangements for the media companies. That's what it is. With print media, it is established around an organisation that lacks any power of coercion or penalty and which operates in the main to excuse the transgressions of its members. Even the funding of the Press Council is dodgy. Because it is funded by publishers on a formula based on circulation, News Limited is a major contributor. That is, the body which is adjudicating on complaints is funded by the largest newspaper group, where obviously many of the complaints must arise in the first instance. Dennis Muller tells us that the Press Council's own research, this is important, the Press Council's own research shows newspaper executives are much more likely to be satisfied with the outcome than are complainants. Well, quite so. But damningly, the former chairman of the Press Council, the recently retired Professor Ken McKinnon, said on the occasion of his departure that the media fail, and I quote him, to live up to its own rhetoric on ethics, privacy and independence. It's a pretty damning thing to say, I should have thought. David Salter, in his The Media We Deserve, said about self-regulation, it is the most astonishing yet unremarked hypocrisy of the Australian media. An industry that devotes so much of its energy to questioning the motives and morality of others nevertheless believes it can and should be trusted to regulate itself. Our media wish the full force of the law to bear down without fear or favour on everyone except themselves. The faintest suggestion that the output of our print, radio and television empires might benefit from some legislative attention is invariably met with the rolling thunder of outraged editorials, all protesting the evil of any such assault on the sacred freedom of the press. Salter went on to remark that the philosophical justification for self-regulation stretches no further, he says, than that most overquoted principle, freedom of the press in the public interest. That's it. He went on to say, freedom of the press cannot also be freedom to lie, freedom to deceive, freedom to unlawfully incite or alarm, or to purchase it, or to pursue a criminal purpose. He said, and this, I think, is a powerful sentence, the only real regulatory power is the law. And the law is usually at its best when journalism is at its worst. The fact is, it is naive in the extreme to believe that a clutch of large companies, in this case media companies, will or can conduct their affairs on some sort of trustee basis, having permanent regard for the public interest, leaving these companies to actually determine what that public interest is. We do not do this with other large companies in respect of such things as trade practices or competition policy, but we do it with media companies. They get exemption from the Privacy Act provisions, which every other large company is subject to. And there is only one reason, freedom of the press. Yet when the Law Reform Commission recommended that the media exemption should be maintained, but with some tweaking for accountability, the media companies moved immediately into high dudgeon. Everything is working well is the constant and only public refrain. The fact is, the intellectual case for adoption of the Commission's modest recommendations is barely assailable, and is laid out in Chapter 42 of the report. The Commission recommended two new limitations to the exemption for acts and practices in the course of journalism. That is, a definition of journalism should be introduced for the purposes of the Privacy Act, and a small change made to the definition of a media organisation. The more significant recommendation was that media organisations should not be left entirely to themselves in setting standards, with the introduction of measures that would continue the exemption only where a media organisation was committed to adequate privacy standards developed in conjunction with the Privacy Commission and the Australian Communications and Media Authority. In other words, no longer on a good behaviour basis, putting out a statement they comply, but in fact, coming to a negotiated position with the Privacy Commission and the Australian Communications and Media Authority under the law. In the light of the obvious shortcomings in the current system, this seems pretty sensible to me. But let me just read you the specific recommendation of the Commission. It's 42.3. The Privacy Act should be amended to provide that media privacy standards must deal adequately with privacy. This is reasonable enough, you would have thought, that media privacy standards must deal adequately with privacy in the context of the activities of a media organisation. Recommendation 42.4, the Office of the Privacy Commissioner, in consultation with the Australian Communications and Media Authority and peak media representative body, should develop and publish criteria for adequate media privacy standards, and actually they actually commit themselves, criteria for adequate media privacy standards and a template for media privacy standards that may be adopted by media organisations. Now, John Hartigan and others in defending media standards claim there are only a small number of complaints and breach findings. Now, this is actually true of formal complaints. The Press Council published 30 decisions on formal complaints between July last year and the end of May. Six concerned privacy, two were upheld. But importantly, we don't have figures on how many complaints are made directly to the media organisation concerned and their resolution, or the ones people feel aggrieved about but then desist from making. Factors other than the efficacy of the system may explain the low reported numbers, if in fact it is the case. Of course, many people believe there's no point in doing it. One limitation on existing schemes is that complaints can usually be made only by the person directly affected by the alleged breach of privacy, although the Australian Communications and Media Authority has own motion powers, and under those, apparently, it's investigating the Channel 7 report regarding the David Campbell matter in Sydney. Another factor is that people don't complain because they run the risk of attracting more attention to an issue, thus compounding the problem they're dealing with in the first place. Or they believe the Press Council, despite the involvement of public members undertaking an investigation of a complaint, lacks true independence. In other words, they expose themselves, devote a ton of time and energy only to get the brush off. Perhaps there are a few complaints because most people wouldn't know what to do or where to go. Again, Dennis Muller's work from his research tells us 3% of the public know of the MEAA, while only 4% know of the Press Council. I mean, it's not on everyone's lips, the Press Council. The Australian Privacy Foundation wasn't far off the mark in stating that the whole system is ineffectual and that there are relatively few complaints because there is a widely held public perception that when it comes to privacy, the media are effectively above the law. Well, who was surprised then that the one mechanism of accountability that stands out for excellence amongst journalists is not the industry's self-regulatory bodies, but Media Watch. As Dennis Muller again told the ABC's Media Watch in his survey of journalists, Media Watch scored 9.3 on an 11-point scale, and it was by far and away the most admired of all the accountability mechanisms, and it's a television program. It's not even a properly instituted accountability mechanism. So, moving forward, as our Prime Minister might say, what could be done to improve underlying conduct in journalism while actually improving the framework? Well, first, industry leaders and the profession should acknowledge that improvements are needed. I mean, does it take that much to acknowledge that improvements are needed? Instead of standing aggressively behind the status quo, dressed in the cloak of the Fourth Estate, they need to talk more about responsibility, more about the importance of ethics, more about improvement in the standards of journalism in all respects. Well, we mightn't be able to do much about some online players, but those in the mainstream need to provide real leadership in managing themselves and any self-regulatory system. On the issue of promoting high standards and transparency, there aren't many Australian publications or broadcasters that appear to have followed the example elsewhere in various places around the world of appointing an internal ombudsman or public editor with a role to champion best practice, investigate complaints generally, and with a public platform to explain or attempt to explain news judgments by a media company or newspaper and questionable calls on privacy and other standards. We don't do any of that. On enforcement of decisions arising from the investigation of complaints, those involved in self-regulation should be aware that public and private sector organisations covered by the Privacy Act are on notice of a significant proposed step up in enforcing compliance with the law. Minister Ludwig has announced that the government will amend the Privacy Act to introduce civil penalties to be imposed by the Federal Court or the Federal Magistrates Court for, quote, serious breaches when other enforcement measures are not sufficient. The minister said, quote, they will be serious sanctions. It is essential we have a robust system in place to protect the privacy of individuals, unquote. The existing Press Council scheme, already criticised over the lack of enforcement powers, may look even weaker in comparison to these new powers delivered under the Privacy Act. This is a separate issue from the proposed statutory cause of action and relates to an appropriate sanction following investigation by the Privacy Commissioner of compliance with the law. Let me give an example. That was the Commissioner's recent finding that Google had breached the Privacy Act by collecting unsecured Wi-Fi payload data using their Street View vehicles. So they go up and down the street, pick stuff off out of the air. They're not a media company, they're not a newspaper. And this is why the Privacy Act is important when it applies to corporations. Sanctions available to the Privacy Commissioner were limited to a requirement for an apology and acceptance of an undertaking to do better in the future. Under what is now proposed, every business with a turnover of more than $3 million a year will potentially be subject to such financial penalties imposed by a court. This is likely to concentrate minds on the importance of compliance with privacy principles a little more, perhaps, than hitherto. Media organisations outside the scope of the Act need to consider whether thrashing serious breaches of privacy, and you know this, Glenn, I'm going to use this phrase, with a warm lettuce, should continue to be all that their self-regulatory systems can deliver. And that's what they do. They give breaches of privacy a good banging with a warm lettuce to continue to see that their self-regulatory systems are up to scratch. Second, media organisations should be sending an important message about where they stand on these issues if they indicated they are prepared to work with, not against, the modest reforms proposed by the Commission for continuation of the media exemption from the Privacy Act. Third, industry and professional leaders should get back to an issue which has defied reformers for years, the idea that, with regard to ethics and standards, the media would benefit from unified arrangements, not all those ones I described earlier, seven different arrangements, for instance, in television, but unified arrangements, consistent principles and uniform enforcement mechanism applying to all outlets, newspaper companies, journalists, broadcast companies and internet service providers. And fourth, more attention to guidance, education and training will continue to be an issue, especially while some senior journalists and those to whom they report claim that the public interest is anything that the public might find interesting. The public interest means publication or non-publication guided by what is in the interest of the public as a whole, not what readers or an audience might find interesting or titillating. It's not always straightforward or easy, I think we accept that. But as mentioned previously, it's claimed to be at the centre of the media's claimed right to publish generally and said to be a central determinant in deciding that publication of censored material is justified. In other words, if it's got a lot of onlookers, well, therefore, it's in the public interest. However, when it suits the argument, media interest seems prepared to jettison the public interest concept and the important balancing of interests that they claim to manage and get correct every day and most of the time. It's apparently too hard even for judges. the aforementioned News Limited lawyer, Justin Quill, writing in last Friday's Australian, argued the dangers to open justice from a proposed change of the law regarding suppression of court proceedings that would give judges power to impose an order where the public interest requires it. He said, how could including a power that can only be exercised in the public interest be a bad thing? And then he answered his own question by saying, the main problem with public interest is that it's a nebulous concept that is difficult to define and even more difficult to weigh against the circumstances of a case. It's the practical application that will cause the problems. Rather than abandoning the public interest, the media needs to put more time and effort into fostering a better understanding of the term, including the notion of a right to privacy within its own ranks. The last suggestion for change is for the media to get on board in a sensible discussion about a course of action. In other words, they should take the Law Reform Commission's recommendations and be involved in the debate about a sensible course of action for serious breaches. The case for legislation to better define legal rights in this area is that the threats to privacy are escalating dramatically, driven largely by technological change. That the common law, case-by-case exploration of whether there is a recourse for breach of privacy is a slow, piecemeal and fragmented process likely to lead to different approaches in different jurisdictions. That legislation would give effect to our international obligations under Article 17 of the International Covenant. We've signed up to that. We should give effect to it. And that the need for better protection of privacy is being recognised in comparable countries, including traditional peer law countries for Australia, such as the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Canada, and parts of the United States. The door to the development of such a cause of action at common law was opened by the High Court in 2001 in the Australian Broadcasting Corporation versus Leonard Game Meats Proprietary Limited. There, a majority of the court accepted that a tort of privacy might be developed in the future, but the nature of the privacy protection and its relationship with existing causes of action was not made clear. Importantly, to date, two lower courts have held that such a cause of action is part of the common law of Australia. One in Queensland, where the defendant incessantly stalked a local council mayor, the other in Victoria, where the ABC published in radio news bulletins information that identified the plaintiff, a victim of sexual assault. This breached the Judicial Proceedings Reports Act of 1958, a Victorian Act, which makes it an offence in certain circumstances to publish information identifying the victim of a sexual offence. Indeed, Judge Hample in the County Court of Victoria held that, in addition to breaching a statutory duty owed to the plaintiff by virtue of the Judicial Proceedings Reports Act, the ABC and two of its employees were liable to the plaintiff in equity for breach of confidence and in tort for invasion of privacy. In a few cases, the courts have ruled there is no cause of action for breach of privacy. In other words, we're starting to see now these pieces emerge in the common law, not just in Australia, but abroad. The Australian Law Reform Commission proposal is that the present uncertainty at law should be addressed through legislation to create a general cause of action for an unwarranted serious breach of privacy. The Commission recommended that a legal action should be available to remedy a serious invasion of personal privacy. A legal action should be available to remedy a serious invasion of personal privacy where the individual had a reasonable expectation of privacy, which someone in the shower might have, and the conduct complained about would be regarded as highly offensive to a reasonable person. This is expressly what the Commission is proposing. Further, the plaintiff would have to satisfy the court in each case that the public interest in privacy outweighs other matters of public interest. So there's a very high bar here, including the interest in informing the public about matters of public concern and allowing freedom of expression. As the then President of the Commission, Professor David Weisbrot, and Deputy President, Professor Les McCrimmon, who conducted the review, said at the time, the proposal sets a high hurdle for success when a media organisation is involved. In other words, frivolous or vexatious claims about privacy will be tested against these public interest matters. By including the public interest test covering only highly offensive conduct and placing the onus of proof squarely on the person complaining of the breach, the Commission has set a very high bar, taking into account the concerns of artists and media organisations about respecting freedom of the press and freedom of expression. Indeed, some privacy advocates and civil libertarians argue that we've set the bar much too high, said Professor David Weisbrot and his deputy president. And in fact, they have set the bar high. But the fact is, their proposal is a sensible proposal. While some media voices shout outrage at the suggestion that there should be a law blocking a cause of action for breach of privacy, others, including Mark Scott, think differently. Mark Scott told the Australia's Right to Know conference in Sydney in March last year. He said, "With digital surveillance, location tracking, and genetic tracing becoming commonplace, there is a very firm case for the law to allow people to protect their privacy. It's a fundamental human right," he said. The Australian Law for Reform Commission proposal for a new statutory right of privacy, properly worded, is a sophisticated idea worthy of serious debate. To dismiss even the need to address the issue, the need to have a thoughtful and comprehensive debate, doesn't seem to me, he said, to be in keeping with the openness and plurality of perspectives that media freedom should be about. Well, good on Mark Scott at the ABC. Mr. Scott's colleagues in the industry should pick up the point. So let me conclude perhaps this way. We know in this, the age of knowledge, the age of truly mass communications, with the ubiquity of digital tools, that the occasions for incursions in the privacy of people will continue to rise exponentially. We can take the determinist view, which concedes that the privacy of all of us is now effectively gone. Or we can assert that an innate right of humanity, of indeed the human condition, is the right to individual privacy. Or as Warren and Brandeis put it over a century ago, the right to be let alone. I believe we're stronger as a society when each of us are stronger. And by stronger, I mean not having important liberties shorn away from us in some revelatory information free-for-all. The social contract, which we're all subject of, involves a surrender of certain rights in exchange for other societal benefits and protections. But at the core of that contract, there cannot be and must never be derogation such that the notion of individuality is materially or permanently compromised. The essence of the dignity of each of us goes to our individuality and our primary need to be ourselves. Not ourselves shared with billions of others, not ourselves x-rayed by the new intrusive technologies, not ourselves ground to an amorphous mass of human sameness. For these reasons, privacy will always matter. Principles matter. It will matter because the right to it represents a core in an inalienable human liberty. This is why it will still matter in the face of the otherwise overwhelmingly invasive technologies, in the face of the attempts by the image and news wholesalers to have us believe that we live in the age of a new normal, a normal where these astringent and corrosive facilitations are not simply to be tolerated, but accepted within a framework of powerless resignation. What the Law Reform Commission has put on offer is a proposal to remove uncertain and possibly haphazard and fragmented development of the law in favour of a unitary approach flowing from national legislation. Legislation to create a general cause of action for unwarranted and serious breaches of privacy. If in certain circumstances people had or believed they had a reasonable right to privacy and that privacy was breached, people should have a right of action in law by way of remedy. Not simply a right to complain, but a right of action. Not a right to complain to a media-run and funded industry mechanism, a right of action at law. For as David Salter reminded us, the only real regulatory power is the law. As I said, Minister Ludwig has already announced that the government will amend the Privacy Act to introduce civil penalties with serious sanctions. This will be, in Australia, a new standard for corporations. The notion, therefore, that media corporations should enjoy different self-developed and self-regulated standards instead of regulation by exemption is simply opportunist. Every day the media is out there insisting on ever higher performance standards in the community, urging the full force of the law be applied to transgressions, but not to itself. The hypocrisy, to use a John Hardigan phrase, is stomach-churning. Industry leaders and the profession itself should acknowledge that the current free-for-all cannot go on, that invading the privacy of celebrity starlets, models and sometimes ordinary non-consenting members of the public, as Jack Waterford put it, has naught to do with the public interest and everything to do with the profit flowing from the implicit consent of victims who are suborned to the revenue task. Industry leaders and media organisations should indicate they are prepared to work with and not against the modest reforms proposed by the Australian Law Reform Commission for the continuation of the media exemption from the Privacy Act, and to acknowledge that the media in general would benefit from legal clarity, consistent principles and uniform national enforcement when it comes to respect for privacy. The media's alternative is to do what the media normally does: use its muscle to bully the government into shredding the community's right to privacy, or more particularly, to have the government turn a blind eye while the media shreds the community's right to privacy. To date, governments have been pretty wary about meddling with the media, but even wary ones will pick up the public disquiet. And in this, the age of poll-driven policy, it's likely the governments will be encouraged to act, and when they do, the remedies will be sharper and more punitive. Far better for media organisations to negotiate now around the Commission's sensible and moderate proposals than wait for the counterpunch, which has to come. Thank you for listening.
And so, to close proceedings with thanks, Mr. Keating asked that we hear him with patience, and he rewarded us in return with a stimulating, provocative and thoughtful lecture about the neglect of privacy, exactly the sort of lecture that should be offered at a Centre for Advanced Journalism. Tonight's presentation follows, in fact, a number of important public lectures sponsored by the Centre over the past year by figures including former Prime Minister John Howard and the Managing Director of the ABC, Mark Scott. Each has recognised the key role of the media and now in our public lives, and the difficulty of establishing clear moral boundaries about the business of journalism. But few have spoken with the passion, knowledge and determination of tonight's lecturer. So please, let us thank again Mr. Paul Keating.